So we begin the second talk in the five talk 10 class series on the five aggregates. And I think a couple of things is that different traditions move different in different relationship to the aggregates. The five hindrances, excuse me. Had a senior moment. The five hindrances, and that each that different traditions move differently in relationship to the hindrances of practice. When you're an urban Buddhist, which I assume that we would claim reference to, we don't have time to develop some of the breeding grounds for prolonged solitude. At least most of us don't. Sort of encased samadhis, jhana absorptions, etc., in which, in order to acquire those states, oftentimes deep abiding silence, physical silence, is necessary. Getting one's senses removed from entertainment and stimulation, abiding in kind of remote areas. And then absorbing in on a particular focus point of reference. And that is fine if you're inclined towards that type of practice. But if we are not inclined towards that, if we are fully engaged, if we have fully engaged lives, which I think most of us do, then we are not giving up anything by bypassing that level of asceticism at all. In fact, I think the fully engaged life is the most meaningful life that one can have as they move deeply into their spiritual journey. But it does require a different orientation to the hindrances rather than to putting them in abeyance, acquiring one samadhi and then coming out. We tackle the whole project head on. And if you look at it, what we're trying to do here, we don't want to lose the main focus of what we're trying to do. We are trying to deconstruct the sense of self so that we're not constantly caught in the web of its trance, so that we're not seeing life only from the perspective of self and other. And so we can never be too far removed from that view and understanding. If we get too far removed from it, we will find ourselves using our meditation towards competing strategies, competing ends. And they can actually move us in a disadvantaged way towards our spiritual growth. And this is a very hard it's very hard to understand this because all of us are given towards the same desires and the same enjoyments and the same level of comfort, the same appreciation for pleasure. And yet, the meditation seems to be calling forth something else from us, not just the usual and normal way that we live in relationship to the experience of the world, pursuing the pleasurable and avoiding the unpleasurable, but something else is being asked from us, being pulled out from us. If we look at the hindrances as the ways, as the strategies in which the way the sense of self builds upon itself to become somebody, if you pursue the pleasurable and avoid the unpleasurable, if you become enamored by sleepiness so that with every time you have a slight lull in energy, we try to find our way towards a nap, and restlessness drives us into frenetic activity, and we are governed by the doubt that we have about ourselves. All of those, if you follow those hardened core conditioning patterns, then we will be constructing day after day, moment after moment, the very sense of self that we're trying to deconstruct through our spiritual practice. And deconstruction of self doesn't mean that we are leaving ourselves behind. It means we're understanding what we are. That's what it means to deconstruct oneself. So we have to, in order to get a sense of how the self is constructed, we have to begin to look at how the hindrances are so compelling, they have such a compelling need for us to play them out energetically. When a desire comes up, we just find ourselves moving almost tragically towards the resolution of a desire that we haven't even examined. And many of us have been caught very foolishly in the play of that from time to time. So when we are looking at what it is that causes the world and ourselves to feel as if we're divided, to feel as if things are outside of us, which is what I call the deconstructing the sense of self, we'll see that what causes that sense of division is trying to run after or avoid experiences. That is the basis on which the sense of self and other originates. So if we're going to deconstruct the sense of self, we have to have a different understanding, a different willingness to explore those very difficult patterns. A couple of weeks ago, we looked at the desiring mind, and tonight we're going to look at the aversive mind, the aversive mind. But let us get a sense that this meditation, that this spiritual journey really has a single view that we're operating from. There aren't two conflicting views here. There's one view that holds the truth, and if we get lost in the other view being the one in which the experiences of our life feel so compelling or so compulsively aligned with our desires and so aversive to our unpleasant experiences, then we will just remain isolated, lonely, and separated, which is what our spiritual journey is trying to resolve. So we can't use those strategies, desire and fear, and play upon them in the same that we have throughout our life if we expect to resolve this problem. We have to look at them completely differently. We have to be willing to put ourselves out there to explore something completely new in ourselves. As a quote that I liked very much from a book called Passages by Gail Sheehy goes like this: with each transition, some magic must be given up. Some cherished illusion of safety and comfortably familiar sense of self must be cast off to allow for the greater expansion of our own understanding. Times of crisis, of disruption, or constructive changes are not only predictable but desirable. They mean growth, because the blow of a life accident hits harder if it coincides with a critical passage in the life cycle. It may force us to resolve the issue of that passage more effectively. The point, I think, is that when we take up a spiritual practice with sincerity, it's not going to be business as usual for us. We can't play at it. It's not as if we can continue to play out the world of our sensual desires and aversions, hold the same opinions we've had and held about our life, political or whatever, and expect to have any resolution of the central problem, which is at the heart of all spiritual practices, which is the resolution of this sense of separation and division. And we will be tested enormously because our character development is at stake. Could I ask everybody to sit up and not lie down? I was at the Forest Refuge teaching last month. There was a woman there who has lung cancer, has lung cancer, and is staying at the Forest Refuge as her lung cancer, which is not being treated. is slowly consuming her, really. And she has had and has periods of coughs, fits of coughing, where she can't control her coughing. So she was sitting in the meditation hall along with other people, and she started to have one of those coughing fits, and I could see people beside her grow a little agitated by the fact that she was coughing, and it was disturbing their silence. And so very politely, she got up and left the meditation hall. And I got up and followed her out, and I caught her in the hall, and I put my hands on her shoulders, and I looked right into her eyes, and I said, "Listen, you go back into the hall. You let us deal with the problem of your coughing." She said, "Well, thank you very much," but she chose to not go back. And I said, "That's fine." But the point was that here it is. You see, what are we doing? You know, what are we doing? Are we trying to protect our enclave of quiet? Are we trying to isolate ourselves out even more rather than to connect more, which is the right way to move this spiritual journey? But we can become more insulated in our view and opinion about what should be happening around us and what I need for my spiritual growth, and feel less and less connected in heart, in compassion, in love for that which is going on around us, because we're trying to become less involved and have all sorts of ideas on how to do that, often at the interruption of that very sense of connection itself. So somebody is moving or coughing beside you, so what? I had my ideas of what practice was supposed to provide. When I went off to Asia, they got blown away, because nobody cooperated with the Western perception of quiet. I had spent 3 years in a meditation center that was very quiet in the country, just absolutely still. And I went to Asia, and there was the meditation hall or the monastery was right in the center of a town where there were loudspeakers, and in Asia everybody booms their music over loudspeakers because they think everybody wants to hear it. So they had just this tremendous noise factor. Plus, right next to the meditation hall, another building was being built, all manually. And the Burmese were not quiet. They just chattered all day long. And then I would go back to my meditation hut, and there would be a big spider, as big as my hand, on the wall, and ants crawling back, and I had lice in my robes, and I thought, and prickly heat, and I thought, it's going to either take me so that I have to quit, or I have to surrender. Those are my options. And I didn't need a teacher telling me my options. I could see them because I was very close to my breaking point. And because the level of comfort, my level of expectation wasn't being met. So what do I do? What do we do, you see? What is the heart of the teaching? We have to come back to the heart of, what is the part of the teaching? Is it avoidance? If it's avoidance, then let's avoid. Because if that's it, and do we think we can use avoidance to get to interconnection? I have yet to see anybody resolve that conflict, although many monks have tried in their desperation towards jhana absorption. I have yet to see very many people resolve that and come out of that with any sense of wholeness, of integrity, of accommodation. And so we luckily do not have that opportunity in our life, or we could become very distorted in our understanding of meditation. So it's accommodation. It's living in harmony with. It's surrendering one's objections, surrendering one's resistance. That is where the meditation, that is where Buddhism points. And if we find ourselves becoming more irritable through our meditation, then we are meditating with wrong view. We are in the wrong perspective to what we need to do. And when we have our hindrances come up, what is it that we first need to do is to connect with them, not avoid them. Because this interconnectedness has no outlier. There is nothing outside of the boundaries of interconnection. Nothing. Put a single atom outside and heaven and earth are forever separated. So that means everything of body, mind, and spirit has to be resolved in one's heart. And when the hindrances arise, the first thing we need to do is to find, because there's going to be two levels of intentionality that are going to come out of us. There's going to be the, what I call the secondary level of intentionality, is what the hindrance seems to indicate that we want from life or avoid from life. And we can follow the pattern of that hindrance towards the acquisition of what it is that we're grasping or needing to grasp, or pushing away or trying to avoid. And that will have the effect of creating a disengaged, disconnected view. Because we can't pursue and avoid objects and be connected with them at the same time. Or we can go to our primary intentionality, which is that deep spiritual longing, that if we don't immediately give ourselves over to the secondary intentionality, which is the grasping and the holding back, we'll find our way to that primary intentionality. And that primary intentionality wants to be fulfilled, but it realizes fulfillment doesn't come in playing out the compelling strategies of the hindrances. Of just getting engrossed in the hindrances and just playing them out. Every desire coming by, having me force myself into a particular action, acquisition, grasping, clinging mode. Or in this particular hindrance talk, the opposite of that, the aversion, the wanting to cut away part of our experience, to eliminate part of our life. This whole thing is our life. Everything that's happening is our life. There is no component that can be carved away and it remain whole. It's all or nothing. That's the way it's coming at us. It's total or it's nothing, or it's divided. It's total or it's divided. And if we're going to take it all on, then we have to take it all on. Everything internally and everything externally. And so meditation can become a way of avoiding impending painful or fearful developmental tasks that we have. It can be a way of escaping ourselves and by doing so then we miss an opportunity to mature our character and to grow in a spiritually advantaged way. There was a friend of mine when I was first at IMS, who set every single three-month course that I was there. And at that time, we had all set maybe one, but nobody set endless three-month courses. And this guy was sitting, I think, his third or maybe his fourth three-month course. And I thought, wow, we had all this projection for anybody that could sit like that. Now it's not so uncommon, but it was back then. And so before this next three-month course began, I went to him and I said, projecting a lot on him, I said, well, I'm really impressed with you and sitting like that. I come to find out that what he's really trying to do is get away from his relationship with his father for 3 months. So he was coming to the three-month course not to do the sitting, but because he couldn't stand his father and he needed to get away, and this was the perfect opportunity to do that. And I thought, my God, that's a distorted reason for meditating. I hope we all understand. You can't use the meditation with the strategy of avoidance and expect it to produce what it is that we're trying to produce, which is interconnectedness. We have to go into problems, not avoid them. Go right into them. And we have to be willing to step into new terrain. Step into new areas of ourself. And that's part of the accommodation. And to let go other parts of ourself that have been so hardened and conditioned and were so adamantly ours and were so righteous about, and all of the different opinionation and ways that we hold our lives around particular special interests that we have, all of that. And we think, if I let that go, what will come back? What will float up, you see? If I let that go, and what if it all sinks? Which is a fear we all have. If I let go of this, if I let go of this that's very important to me, would it ever float back up? There are no guarantees that it ever will. And so most of us have to start with this basic misperception of the unpleasant life being something we absolutely need to avoid, that the difficult is not something that has any welcoming quality to it. Because the way most of us think on the level of thought, the plain level of thought, the trance level of thought, which is how most of us operate in this world, is to consolidate our gains, you know, and it's around pleasure that our whole principle of operation works. We build upon what we have, where pain feels somehow like a failure. Difficulty feels like a lack of meaningful success, of accomplishment. And we're not advancing sufficiently if we have so much, too much difficulty. But somehow it shows a retardation in our growth or something. I don't know. And that's the way we think. And so when we come upon a difficult situation, we want to circumvent it. We want to get around it as quickly as possible. But where do we escape? You see, I mean, just we have to ask ourselves, if we're within wise view, first of all, is escaping going to allow interconnection? Is it the deepest longing I have for myself? Is it in accordance with my deepest intention to escape from life? If we keep bringing forth wise view and wise intention, we'll have to navigate. It gives us a clear map of how to navigate through the hindrances. Where do we escape from? Abraham Lincoln said, where there is suffering, there is also holy ground. Well, that's a true wisdom there. Because reality is what it is, you see. It is what it is. So where do we escape? Well, there's only one place that we can escape when we're wanting to escape. Since reality is, and the pain or difficulty is part of that reality, there's only one way that we can escape it in the moment that it's occurring. And that's mentally denying it. Mentally. But that's no escape at all. That's just cutting ourselves off from life. That's just shielding ourselves. That's just putting up a blank wall, a deadened wall, so that life can't get in. And we begin to see that it's only the mind keeps creating its own reality. That the real reality is always out here, but the mind keeps creating its reality in opposition to the reality that's always here. I don't know if any of you saw in the paper that the Catholic Church has just recently canceled or negated, or whatever you do from the pulpit, limbo. Now, for 2,000 years, it turns out that limbo is what they have been telling everyone that happens to children if you're not baptized. You go to limbo. which isn't hell, but it's not heaven. Now, can you imagine 2,000 years of anguish that has been propagated from the Catholic Church with the assurance that limbo was true? If you're a mother and your child wasn't baptized and you were told about that, think how you would feel. Or if you were a child and you weren't baptized. You see that? Now, suddenly, 2,000 years later, I don't think it's true. They just decide 2,000 years later that it's not true. They just cross it out. Doesn't give you much confidence in what they say the rest of what is true, does it? Doesn't give you a lot of confidence that they just won't cross something else out at some point. I mean, if that isn't mind created, we're not interested in a reality like that, that can be pulled from us at any particular time and claimed no longer to serve the general population. I'm interested, and I hope you are with me, what reality really is. Not through dictates or papal decrees, but what it really is, that can never, the rug of that can never be pulled out from under. What is that, you see? And that takes our direct participation, our direct awareness, to really see what it is, to really see what avoidance is, and see whether we can ever avoid anything. Isn't that a fair question? We think we can, but that's the problem. We think we can. But can we? Or can we just create such tension in ourselves through the thought of trying and trying to deny and resist that creates even more tension than if we acquiesced to the experience itself? I mean, we begin to see how this whole thing is put together. We'll have a thought, and the thought has an emotional residue in the body, a thought of one's mother. And that can be pleasant or unpleasant. And then a whole sense of emotion, a feeling tone of pleasant or unpleasant, and then a whole emotional experience. That emotion feeds back into our thinking through further story and elaboration on that story, which further encourages the emotional life in our body. And that then feeds more thinking until the story is being played out in front of us. And then what happens is that from that story, from the characterization of what we have become through that story, we meet our mother from that projection. Or we just happen to meet anyone's mother because it sets us up to have either a pleasant or unpleasant experience far beyond just our own particulars. But where does that come from? The cause and effect of life. This wheel that constantly is turning in us. From what? From a thought. A thought leading and inducing and playing upon an emotion leading to greater thinking. What is that when we look at it? What is it really? What is a thought? What is this emotion? With innocence, not with sophistication, not with the knowing mind, but with the innocent mind. And then, of course, because we find ourselves in a whole set of circumstantial problems that have been caused through our elaboration of story, immersed in more thinking, stimulated by more emotion, we think we can then think our way out of the problem. I'll just think my way out. But thought got us into it. It sure isn't going to get us out of there. And when we do that, we're making a statement. Not here, not now. That's the statement that thought makes for us. Later. Because life lived in the mind is a life defined by our hindrances. It's that simple. We will be enslaved with them and to them. And if we look to the mind, toward the mind to be able to save us from that, we are looking towards dead end. It doesn't allow a resolution, a true resolution of the problem, because the reality of the situation is not thought-induced. It is here and now, not here and some other time. I too wish there were other realities I could choose from. I too wish that Burma had been quiet and without insects and on, and the food and the weather. And on, everywhere I turned, there was an objection. The Buddha said there are four ways that we can deal with that kind of aversion. He said we can blame it. And he meant by that we can blame it on others. You told me I had to come to Burma or whatever. Or we can blame it on ourselves. We can deny its occurring. We can despair that it's occurring. Or we can discern to see if it's true. And he says, only discernment will lead you out of the turmoil. And if we look at it, we begin to see, is what my mind's telling me, is my ability to avoid something, is that a fact? Is there really avoidance here? Or am I just creating a stir of intentionality and a problematic view that I can escape from this pain, put distance between myself and this pain, when in fact I cannot do that? You see, avoidance is a betrayal of being. And of course, in any betrayal of being, we have lost all sense of accountability, of self-accountability in that moment. But an accountable person, a person of wisdom, a person of growth, a person of the Tao, which is why I'm reading from the Tao these days, doesn't necessarily take the easy road. Okay, let's see. Let's just look at it. Let's just spend a moment here. Is this something I can escape from? Difficult as it may be, and the wish of that it weren't happening, have nothing to do with the fact that it is. Is there any way that this fact can bring me into itself? Instead of the avoidance of it, can I just, okay, let's look at this thing. That's it. No other life but this one. There is no other possibility of a life other than what is now occurring. And to eliminate any other possibilities is to eliminate the different forms of suffering that I have in relationship to my options. The problem when I do that is that when I release my need for the other options, when I release the tension of the other options, and I fall into reality, lo and behold, what I'm left with is vulnerability. I have nothing to protect me from the raw difficulty that I face. And I don't like being without defenses. That's why I seek denial or blame or whatever other form of defense I can. Rationalization, justification. Vulnerability is by far the hardest state of mind to accommodate. Because my self-control, my self-empowerment, my issues of defending myself for security reasons are now gone. I don't have those. Not when I am exposed in a raw way to the fact of the difficulty. And so instead of facing that rawness of heart, of life, just the textural rawness of life, I'll move off. I'll put a shield in front of me. The shield then is the avoidance of that and seeks reprimand or vengeance as a way to retaliate for that difficulty. But then I feel properly righteous in my own indignation, in my own separation. It leaves me feeling more cut off, more isolated, lonelier. So what about our styles? You see, the people, when we all sit here, we all have styles of how are we with the difficult? Better question, how are we in conflict? What's our style when conflict arises in our life? Right? Ellen and I were going through an exhibition this weekend. And it was an exhibition on the Titanic. So it had it showed how people reacted once the iceberg struck the Titanic. And it showed three different character styles, right? So you had they weren't all by class, although much of that was. Class differentiation. But one of the styles was, the complete denial. Even though water was coming up the steps, and they were going to sleep, I'm just going back and it'll all be fine. I'm just going back in and sleep. And I'll wake up and people have cared for this this minor problem that occurred. Well, that wasn't very useful. Then there was, of course, the style of panic, right? Where, the slightest jar of the ocean liner, all hell breaks loose, and people are climbing over each other, often at the expense of the people that they're smothering underneath them to get to the lifeboats, and sometimes dressing up as women, because women and children were allowed in the lifeboats first, so men would sometimes dress up as women to get into the lifeboat. The integrity. Where's the integrity? And then there was the person that was decisive and clear-headed. Like they said that the band formed on the bow of the boat. They played as the boat was sinking. The band continued to play on as the lifeboats were being filled and leaving the ship. And just to be able to hold that, just to be able to hold that moment with some dignity. I hope that what is growing in us is the style of that decisiveness, of that clear-headedness. Because everything else is just compelled by a hindrance. And for us to be able to have some integrity when those moments do arise, those moments of conflict, rather than blaming and obscuring the facts or distorting the facts or rationalizing or any of that, just that clear integrity of being to being, to be able to look at the problem and not have it feel so accusatory or so with such self-implication around it. So when avoidance arises in us, to watch the mind try to move away from the avoidance. And to understand that movement is the problem. Trying to move away from the problem and from that view is trying to solve the problem. I'm trying to move away, to bypass this problem, to circumvent it, to do something with it, to try to solve it. So the mind moves into a corrective phase by conjuring up a reality in which it can circumnavigate the problem at hand. But that is the problem. Moving in relationship to a problem creates the problem, rather than just facing the fact. Just facing the fact of it. Just, okay. Without pretension. What is meaningful, you see? In that moment, what is meaningful is not trying to resolve the problem. That's not what's meaningful. The deeper intentionality is to grow, to learn, to understand from this difficulty so that I can realign myself and interconnect in a way that this problem at this moment won't allow me. That's what becomes meaningful in one's life, not the resolution of some conflict at one's own, for one's own image sake, but for a deeper purpose, a deeper intentionality than that. And some of us are very reluctant to give ourselves over that completely to reality because it feels very unsure, insecure to do that. And so one of the ways that we play with our practice is, how can I get out of harm's way and still pretend to be spiritual? How can I put on a good facade in this situation, right? How can I do that? But the motivation to stop avoiding comes when we have tired of seeking fulfillment from our thinking. When we are tired of avoiding. Simply tired of avoiding. Now we have to be careful because some of us have tendencies towards, such strong tendencies towards self-blame that in self-judgment that just in having a hindrance come up, like a feeling of neediness or wanting something, we feel so self-judgmental that we get stuck, we get frozen in that spiritual fix. I'm not supposed to be having aversion, and I'm not supposed to be having desires, and here I am desiring it. And instead of just doing it, just go ahead and have your second helping. Just let yourself do it if you find yourself in that fix. Because worse than the greed or the aversion is that sense of being stuck in ourselves. Like deer headlights, with a deer in headlights. Just frozen. Just keep it moving. Keep learning. All right, I'm going to give in to this one this time. Just see what happens. This time I'm going to hold back. See what that's like. To be able to play with it, to have that sense of play, rather than that moralism that can form around our spirituality so easily. So we begin by examining the fact of reality. Is this bearable? I mean, is it really all that bad? And what's creating it? What's, if it's so bad, where's the tension? What is my mind doing in this moment? It can only become suffering when my mind is creating an alternative reality of some sort of escape route. So let me see if I can relax that tension. Relax the mental tension and accommodate the fact of what is here. Can this be understood? Can I understand what and how it is that I constantly get enticed into this hindrance? Time and time again. And what is it like when I mentally relieve reality, when I take up a fantasy journey? What's that like? Is that fulfilling? Does it feel that my intention is that intention being fulfilled? My intention of avoidance? And when I'm involved in conflict, what's the nature of this conflict? What am I adding? Where am I holding on to an opinionation, to a stance, and not listening? Where do I refuse to listen in this moment? Where is my heart in this engaged activity? Because we use each other. In urban Buddhism, we use each other. We are not, for the most part, cave dwellers. We're not isolated beings. We use Sangha. That's a part of the fabric of being together. And we do not diminish our potential in any way by using what's at hand. We do not seek isolation at the expense of interconnection. And we sit with our life, in the midst of our life. In Ajahn Buddhadasa's monastery, there was a drawing that a Westerner did some years before, and it had a picture of a dragon's mouth opening like that. And then a monk sitting right in the mouth on the tongue, right in the middle of the jaws of the dragon. And as I was leaving the monastery, he said, sit on the tongue of the dragon. And that's what I teach. And I hope we all can understand the importance of the tongue of the dragon. Thank you. Can we sit for a minute or two? Okay, if anyone has any questions or comments, I'd be happy to listen to them. I'm not sure I will be able to respond to them, but we'll give it a go here. Anyone at all? Yes, in the back. So the question is a good one. She says that many times when she stays with conflict and just patiently, it will change, and it does have a sense of resolution just in patience, being with something patiently rather than trying to find an immediate way out. But there are times when it doesn't resolve itself, and she's wondering how to move it to that next step of resolution when it doesn't just resolve. Well, without knowing the specifics, I'll just talk about conflict a little bit because I would need to know much more about the specifics to be able to dialogue with you. But first of all, so much of conflict is really opinionation, is one view being held against another. And if you just are patient with the person that you have this difficulty with, you can often start letting the heart open beyond the opinionation. It's like a mother who sees her child embroiled in some kind of messy behavior on the floor, and there's this first this rage of how could you be doing that, you know, with all your blocks all over the place. If you just hold on to that patiently and just sit with it, or just stay with it for a while, what will come and will become the default position will not be the rage, but will be the maternal love. That will rise sufficiently, or the sense of connectedness, and then you can operate not from conflict. You can operate from discernment and resolution, but not from reactivity and conflict. So metta meditation has that as its point. It tries to bring forth connectedness rather than opinionation. It's an attempt to bring the sense of being, that there is much more, we have much more in common than the opinion we have in difference. And to let that sit for a while so that that aspect can be seen. What we have a back hedge that's shared by our neighbors in the back. And I was out cutting the hedges, and they claimed I cut their side of the hedge on their side. I didn't, but they thought I did. Some of the clippings fell from the top onto their side, but I didn't crawl on their side and do the cut. But they thought I did. So they wanted to have a big meeting. That was on 9/10 that I got a phone call from. Then 9/11 happened, and then 9/12 they called back and said, it's kind of silly to have a meeting, isn't it? You see, I put it in perspective that the sense of connection, the sense of being together in things, was much more important than this little minor difficulty of the hedge. And we just don't give perspective to that. That perspective sometimes comes through just the patience of waiting and not reacting right away. It just, things start showing their true proportionality. So that's an important component. The other thing that I find extraordinarily important is the willingness to listen through the opinion. So that when you have an opinion, never consider any opinion to be the whole story. So is it possible for me to listen to another opinion, not giving up mine by God, because then what would I do, right? A funny thing happens when you're listening to somebody else. First, you have to connect with them. You have to release your opinion in order to really listen. So suddenly you're open in a way that you never were when you were just holding on to your opinion. And when you're open, that brings that sense of connectedness. It brings the proportionality of what you're really talking about. And it brings often a resolution just through that simple. But it's the righteous, it's the righteousness within conflict that is the that is where the two sides can't meet. One opinion can never meet another opinion. They're often in opposition, diametrically opposed. So it's this, you know, and I never try to get over it. I don't try to resolve it, because that's just avoidance in a different form. But what I am trying to do in my elderly years is to be more patient with it. Okay, just give it time here. Just give it a day. Give it a day. All right, just give it a day. Okay, so then I, oh boy, as soon as I, well, I'll give it 23 more hours. So that's the way it starts. And then it goes like that for a few hours, and then, you know, it starts changing. I say, well, I didn't do that, you know, I could have done that, and then you start, and then all of a sudden it's not there anymore. And the mood will have switched. See, the mood is often in governance of the righteousness. And the mood is temporary when it isn't being constantly reinforced with the righteousness. So the patience alters the mood. The mood alters the disposition of willingness to listen. And the whole thing gets fluid again. It's the fluidity that we're looking for. The fluidity has its own resolution. Has its own resolution. Other questions or comments? Okay.